I was just staring at my phone this morning, scrolling through the news, and I had this weird, slightly existential moment.
Oh, yeah. One of those mornings.
Yeah, exactly. We are just bombarded with so much information all the time. Facts, opinions, fake news, corrections to the fake news.
It is exhausting.
Right. And it made me wonder, how do we actually know anything is true?
Yeah.
Like, really know it? Is truth something we just download from the world around us, like a software update? Or is it pre-installed on the hard drive of our brains when we're born?
Well, that is the exact question that keeps the lights on in philosophy departments.
I bet.
Usually when you ask that, you're forced to pick a team. You're either Team Plato, believing that ideas are innate and we just have to kind of remember them,
Right.
or you are Team Aristotle, believing we're these blank slates who have to pull truth out of the physical world through our senses.
But today we're looking at a guy who absolutely refused to play that game. He didn't pick a side. He decided to build a massive bridge instead.
A very ambitious bridge.
Very. We are doing a deep dive into the mind of St. Augustine today. We're working off a really fascinating lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes on the history of philosophy, specifically focusing on Augustine's Christian philosophy.
Yes.
And the mission for this deep dive is to unpack how Augustine explains the structure of the universe, the mystery of human knowledge, and a completely mind-bending theory of time.
Yeah, the time stuff is incredible. But what makes this whole mission so interesting is that Augustine is basically the ultimate system integrator.
That's a great way to put it.
He is operating in the fourth century, which is this time of huge, massive transition. He's taking the software of Greek philosophy, specifically Neoplatonism, which was sort of the cutting-edge science of his day.
The intellectual heavyweight stuff.
Right. And he is trying to run it on the hardware of Christian theology.
And it is not a smooth install, is it? I mean, he has to hack the system a bit to make it work.
He definitely has to rewrite some code, but the result is this incredible worldview. To understand where he's coming from, we really have to start with the blueprint of reality.
Right, the forms. Now, for anyone who skipped Philosophy 101, Plato thought there were these perfect forms or ideals existing somewhere out there.
The realm of being.
Yeah, like there is a perfect concept of a horse or the perfect concept of justice floating in this abstract realm. And everything here on Earth is just a cheap knockoff copy of those perfect forms.
To Plato, the physical world is just a shadow. But Augustine has a major problem with the out there part of that theory.
Because he's a Christian monotheist.
Exactly. He cannot have a realm of eternal, godlike forms existing independently of God. If the form of goodness just exists on its own, then God isn't the supreme ruler of everything.
So he has to move the furniture around. He takes these abstract blueprints and he moves them inside the mind of God.
Correct. He calls them rationes aeternae, which translates to eternal reasons or eternal truths.
Okay.
So the blueprint for a horse or for mathematics or for justice, these aren't just floating in the ether anymore. They are God's actual thoughts.
They're the archetypes of his wisdom.
Yes. It grounds reality in a person rather than just some abstract, impersonal force.
Okay, so reality begins as a thought in God's mind. But we don't live in a thought bubble. We live in a world of, mud and trees and changing seasons.
Very messy physical stuff.
Right. So how does Augustine explain how those perfect static thoughts turn into biology? Because a thought doesn't grow leaves.
This is where he gets incredibly inventive, and frankly, it sounds very modern to us today. He introduces the concept of rationes seminales.
Seminal reasons.
Yeah, think of them as seeds.
Seeds of potential.
Yes. Augustine argues that when God created the world, he didn't just snap his fingers and make every single distinct object appear fully formed and static, like a museum display.
Okay.
Instead, he planted these seeds of potentiality into the very fabric of creation.
That reminds me of a zipped file on a computer.
Well, that's a good way to look at it.
Like when you download a massive program, you get one compressed file. The potential for the whole program is in there.
Right?
All the subfolders, the images, the code.
But it has to unpack itself over time to actually run.
Exactly.
That is a surprisingly accurate analogy for a fourth century idea. Augustine sees the universe as unzipping over time. This allows him to explain change and development in nature.
So a species might not appear on day one.
Right, but the potential for that species, the seminal reason, was there from the beginning, just waiting for the right conditions to unfold.
Which is so fascinating because it almost sounds like he's leaving the door ajar for evolution centuries before Darwin even existed. He's saying the universe has the capacity to develop itself based on these pre-programmed instructions.
He is certainly describing a dynamic universe, not a static one. He avoids the idea that God has to constantly tinker with the world just to make a tree grow. The instructions were packed in at the start.
Right.
But here's the catch, and this leads us to the second big pillar of his thought. Knowledge.
The epistemological crisis.
Yes. If the truth, the real capital T truth, like mathematical laws or moral absolutes, is locked away in God's mind as these eternal forms, and we are down here in the physical world,
how do we access it?
Exactly. How do we reach it?
It's that gap again. If I look at a tree, I can see its bark and its leaves. But I can't see tree-ness. I can't see the eternal mathematical truths that describe the tree.
Because your eyes only see the changing physical object.
Right. So how does my mind grasp eternal unchanging truths when I'm just surrounded by temporary changing junk?
Augustine looks at the available options. He rejects Plato's idea of recollection, the idea that we just remember stuff from a past life.
Because Christians don't believe the soul existed before the body.
Correct. And he rejects Aristotle's idea that we can just figure it all out by staring at the physical object long enough, which is called abstraction.
Because you can't get an unchanging truth from a changing object. You can't squeeze orange juice out of a rock.
I like that, yes. So he needs a third element. He says we need a light source. This is his famous doctrine of divine illumination.
Divine illumination. It sounds very mystical, like we're sitting on a mountaintop getting a cosmic download or something.
It does sound like that, but looking at the source lecture, he actually means it in a very technical sense. It helps to think about the mechanics of sight.
Okay, lay it out for me.
To see that coffee cup on your desk, you need two things. You need your eye and you need the cup.
Sure.
But if we turn off all the lights in the room, pitch black, can you see the cup?
No. I need a medium. I need light.
Augustine says the mind works the exact same way. The mind has an intellectual eye, and the eternal truths are the objects we want to see. But the human mind is finite. It cannot see eternal things on its own.
It's sitting in the dark.
Exactly. It needs the light of God to illuminate them. It is a cooperation, a concursus between the human mind and God.
But let me play devil's advocate here for a second. If we need God's light to see truth, does that mean every time an atheist solves a math problem, they are having a religious experience?
That is the million-dollar question.
Because 2 plus 2 equals 4 is an eternal truth.
Yeah.
If an atheist sees that truth, are they seeing God?
Dr. Holmes makes a very important distinction in the lecture here. Augustine is not saying we see God's essence.
Okay.
We aren't plugging a fiber optic cable directly into God's brain. We don't see God. We see by the light of God.
Okay, that clicks. It's like the sun. I don't have to look directly at the sun to use its light to read a book.
In fact, if you look directly at the sun, you'll go blind.
Right, but I can't read the book without it.
That is the core of it. The atheist mathematician is using God's light to see mathematical truths, whether they acknowledge the source of that light or not. The light simply makes the truth visible to the mind.
Wow.
And this actually leads Augustine to a really beautiful and somewhat humbling conclusion about teaching.
Oh, this is the bit from his book, De Magistro, on the teacher.
Yeah.
Where he basically argues that teachers are useless.
Yes.
Which is a bold stance for a guy who spent his entire life teaching.
It is a rhetorical trap he sets. He poses this dilemma. If I say a word to you and you don't know what it means, I haven't taught you anything. It's just noise. But if I say a word and you do know what it means, then I haven't taught you anything new. I've just reminded you of something you already knew.
So if I say quantum entanglement and you don't know physics, it's just noise.
Yeah.
If you do know physics, you say, yeah, I know. In either case, I didn't actually put the knowledge into your head.
Exactly. So Augustine concludes that the teacher is not the person speaking to you from the outside. The true teacher is within.
The inner light.
Yes. It is the Logos, the divine logic, or Christ, enlightening the mind from the inside so you can recognize the truth when it's presented to you.
So when I had that aha moment, that click where a concept just suddenly makes perfect sense, Augustine would say that isn't because the professor explained it perfectly. It's because the inner light illuminated the concept in my own mind.
The professor just pointed your head in the right direction. The light did all the heavy lifting.
I really love that image. It changes learning from a dry data transfer to this moment of inward revelation. But Augustine wasn't just dealing with people who wanted to learn, right? He was also dealing with the trolls of the ancient world.
The skeptics.
Yes.
Or the academics, as they were called back then. They claim that because our senses can be fooled, we can't really know anything for sure. We should just doubt everything.
Like how a straight stick looks bent when you put it in water.
Exactly. And this is where Augustine puts on his boxing gloves. He actually anticipates René Descartes by over 1,000 years.
Everyone knows Descartes' famous line, I think, therefore I am.
But Augustine had his own version way before that. Si fallor, sum.
If I am deceived, I exist.
It's such a masterful takedown.
Break down the logic for us, because it's brilliant.
The skeptic comes along and says, you might be hallucinating right now. This entire conversation could be a complete deception. You can't trust reality.
And Augustine replies.
Fine. Let's assume I am being completely deceived. In order to be deceived, I must exist. A non-existent person cannot be fooled.
You can't trick a zero.
Precisely. Even if I am just a brain in a jar, the jar exists, the brain exists. So he establishes an absolute baseline. I exist.
And from there, he builds what we call the truth ladder. He climbs right from existence up to logic.
Because even if I'm hallucinating, math still works.
Right.
He points out that we know certain logical laws, like the law of non-contradiction. A cannot be non-A. That is a universal rule. It doesn't change based on my feelings or if I'm having a hallucination.
And because these truths are unchangeable, they must come from a source that is itself unchangeable.
So he argues from the existence of truth directly to the existence of God. He's climbing the ladder from I exist to truth exists to God is truth.
It's logic as a spiritual exercise. But let's shift gears for a minute. We've talked about the mind and the truth. What of the thing that's actually doing the thinking, the soul? What is the user manual for the human soul, according to Augustine?
Well, looking at the source, he spends a lot of time defining what the soul is not. It's not a gas. It's not a ghost inside a machine.
He had to fight the Stoics on this, right?
He did. The Stoics thought the soul was a subtle form of matter, like a very thin fluid spread throughout your physical body. Augustine says no. The soul is an immaterial substance. It has absolutely no physical dimensions.
But wait, if it's not made of atoms and it has no dimensions, how does it interact with the body? How does it know if my toe hurts? If the soul isn't physically located in my toe, how does it get the signal?
This is one of the most fascinating details in his psychology. Augustine says the soul rules the body by attention.
Attention.
Yes. It's a vital mental focus. Dr. Holmes uses the example of sitting in a room but thinking about the Senate in Washington, D.C.
Right. My butt is physically in the chair, but my head is in D.C.
Your mind is essentially there, even though your body is here. Your mind isn't limited by geography. So Augustine argues that when you feel pain in your leg, it's not that your soul literally traveled down to your leg.
It's that your soul focused its attention on the signals coming from the leg.
Yes.
So the soul is like a spotlight operator. It can shine its focus anywhere in the body or even across the world in thought without ever physically moving an inch.
And this non-spatial nature is actually his main argument for immortality.
How so?
If the soul doesn't have physical parts, it can't fall apart. It can't decompose the way a physical body does. It is the life giver to the body, and a life giver cannot admit death.
That idea of attention is so crucial because it serves as the perfect bridge to what I honestly think is the most mind-bending part of this entire discussion, Augustine's psychology of time.
Oh, this is where Augustine truly shines. Before him, time was usually defined by the movement of planets or physical objects. Aristotle thought time was just a measurement of motion.
But Augustine turns inward. He asks, where does time actually exist? And his answer is, it exists in the soul.
Walk us through his logic here, because we all feel time passing. We look at clocks, but Augustine implies that's not the whole story at all.
Well, ask yourself, does the past exist?
Not anymore. It's gone. It's history.
Right. Does the future exist?
Not yet. It hasn't happened.
So if the past is gone and the future isn't here, what is actually real? Only the present.
But the present is an infinitesimally small knife edge. I mean, as soon as you say the word now, it's already the past.
Exactly. It's slippery. Yep. So physically, we are trapped in this tiny sliver of reality that instantly vanishes. But I have a sense of continuity. I remember starting this sentence, and I anticipate finishing it. If I lived only on that physical knife edge, I wouldn't be able to speak a coherent sentence.
So how do you do it?
Augustine says that while the past doesn't exist physically, it exists in the soul as memory. And the future exists in the soul as anticipation.
So time is. It's a stretching of the mind.
Yes. He calls it a distension of the soul. We hold the past, present, and future together in our minds in an ever-present now.
Think about listening to a melody.
Perfect example.
If you only heard the exact split-second note being played right now, you wouldn't hear music. You'd just hear unconnected random beeps.
I hear a melody because I remember the previous note. I hear the current note. and I anticipate the next one, and I hold them all together, me attention span.
That is the distinction. Your soul actually mimics eternity by holding a span of time together in its view. And this connects us right back to God. Because if the human soul can hold a few seconds of a melody together, imagine what God's attention is like.
Which leads us to a massive theological headache, doesn't it? God's relationship to time.
It really does. If God is perfect, he cannot change. If he cannot change, he cannot have a past or a future, because that implies he's passing from one state to another.
Right. If God learned something new tomorrow, he wasn't all-knowing today.
So Augustine concludes God must be entirely timeless.
He steps outside the timeline completely. He sees the whole movie real all at once. He's holding the beginning and the end in one single gaze.
Right. For God, it is all one eternal now. He doesn't foresee the future. He simply sees it because he is already there. But, and here is where it gets very messy.
The Bible.
The Bible. The source material highlights a major, major conflict here. We have to look at this tension impartially. The Bible describes a God who acts in history.
He gets angry. He repents. He sends his son. He reacts to human prayer.
Exactly. If I am a sinner today and I repent tomorrow, the Bible says there is joy in heaven.
But if God is timeless, he can't have a before where he was sad and an after where he is happy. That is a change. And a timeless God cannot change.
You've hit on the exact tension. This is the battle between the God of the philosophers, who is static and perfect, and the God of Abraham, who actively intervenes in history.
Dr. Holmes mentions a philosopher named Nelson Pike, who wrote a book called God and Timelessness.
Yes, Pike argues that if you want to keep the biblical personal God, you might have to dump the timeless idea entirely.
So instead of being outside of time, God would be everlasting. Like, he's on the timeline with us, just infinite in both directions.
That is the alternative view Pike presents. God endures through all ages. But our source makes it clear that Augustine sticks to his guns. He defends the timeless view.
How does he reconcile that with the Bible?
He argues that when the Bible speaks of God changing, it's using phenomenal language.
Phenomenal meaning, how it appears to us.
Yes. Like when we say the sun rises, we know the sun isn't actually moving, the earth is turning, but to us, it looks like a sunrise.
Okay.
Augustine says when God repents, God hasn't actually changed. We have changed. Our relationship to him has shifted, so it looks like he changed from our limited time-bound perspective.
It's a defense mechanism for God's perfection. He's trying to keep God from being dragged down into our messy, changing timeline.
Exactly.
So we've got this timeless, unchanging, perfect God, and we are these time-bound, scattered humans. The final question we have to tackle is, how do we bridge that gap?
Mm-hmm.
How do we actually know God? Not just know about him, but truly know him.
This is where Augustine beautifully blends the philosopher and the believer. In his famous book, The Confessions, he asks this amazing question. What do I love when I love God?
It's such a poetic passage. He goes through this whole list. He says, I don't love the light of the sun or the melody of songs or the fragrance of flowers.
Right. He admits he loves the physical world, but he realizes God isn't in those physical things. So he turns inward. He says, I love a kind of light and a kind of voice and a kind of fragrance, but in my soul.
It's an inward journey. He turns away from the physical senses, away from the noise outside, and looks into the depths of his own consciousness.
And this sounds very much like Plotinus and the Neoplatonists, the mystics. They believed you could climb the ladder of your own mind through pure introspection and eventually touch the One.
Does Augustine agree with that?
No.
Can we just think our way to heaven? Can we introspect our way up to God?
He goes part of the way with them. He agrees the path is inward. He agrees we must ascend the mind to find the immutable truth. But he says there is a hard limit.
What's the limit?
The philosopher can climb the ladder and see that there is a God. He can see the land of peace from a distance. But he inevitably falls back down.
Why? Why can't he stay up there?
Because of the weight of his own imperfections. Augustine calls it the weight of habit or sin. The mind might be capable of seeing the light, but the human will is too heavy to stay there. We are constantly dragged back down by our attachments to the physical world.
So introspection isn't enough. You need an elevator.
Yeah.
Or a guide.
You need a mediator. Augustine realizes that the raw intellect isn't enough. You need the forgiveness of Christ to actually cleanse the soul so it can hold on to that vision of God.
So the Neoplatonists have the destination, but Augustine says only Christianity provides the actual way to get there.
It's a journey that starts with reason, looking at the world, looking at the mind, but it absolutely has to end with faith.
Ideally, for Augustine, they are not enemies.
Ugh.
Believe that you may understand, he famously said. Faith opens the door, and reason furnishes the room. He completely legitimized the use of the brain in religion.
You did.
So if we zoom out, what is the big takeaway for you from Augustine? We've covered seminal forms, divine light, the psychology of time, the soul. It's a massive system.
I think the core message is that nothing is random. From the seeds of creation unfolding in nature to the light in our minds allowing us to do math, everything is connected to a central source of intelligence. And Augustine invites us to stop looking for ultimate truth just in the noise of the outside world.
The outward search is ultimately a dead end.
It just leads to distraction. The path to the upward, to God, to truth, is entirely through the inward. By understanding our own minds, our memory, our experience of time, we find the fingerprints of the eternal.
He legitimized the life of the mind for centuries of believers. He showed that you don't have to check your brain at the door to have a deep faith.
And that is a legacy that still holds up 1600 years later. He really is the broad shoulder that Western philosophy stands on today.
I think that's a perfect place to wrap up this deep dive. But before we go, I have one last thought to leave you with. Something for you to just stare at the ceiling and think about tonight.
Let's hear it.
We talked about Augustine's view of time, that the past is just a memory file in your soul and the future is just a projection. That means the only reality you ever actually experience is the exact razor-thin split second of now.
The only place where life actually happens.
Right. But we also said your sense of continuity, your feeling of being a person who exists over time, is held together entirely by your attention. You are actively knitting the past and future together every single second.
Okay.
So if you get truly, deeply distracted, does your reality fall apart? How much of yourself is really just a mental construct that you are frantically maintaining moment by moment?
That is absolutely terrifying. And it also explains why I can never meditate without mildly panicking.
You're welcome. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.
Keep thinking.